up this morning with the sun down shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the news, so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tim Howell. We have Greg on the board. S&P futures down 1050. NASDAQ futures down 48. Who knows if we will stay down. We actually have Dow futures, I think, are probably up. They're up. No, they're actually down 75 as well. Do we have Professor Liu?
Good morning, sir. How are you?
A little pissed off, but other than that, I'm okay.
Let's see. Pissed off. First of all,
better than pissed on.
Yeah, better than pissed on.
Does the FCC even allow us to say that?
Well, on a podcast, you can say pretty much anything.
Okay.
Plus, if we were on the air before 6 o'clock, you can say a lot of stuff. Still can't use the four really bad words, but.
Anyway. Well, we're on the air. It's before 6 o'clock here, so I guess we're safe.
Yeah. So, anywho, just another. Example of our totally lawless city.
What's the latest coming out of there? The last story I saw out of Chicago was Brandon appointing some totally unqualified minister to a buddy of his to the city transportation board, or the regional transportation board. Is that still a thing?
Lou, I am going to have to, very early on here, we're going to have to disagree. You obviously don't get it. Anybody who is a preacher or a community organizer is qualified for everything.
Well, I mean, if you take that outlook, yes, this guy's qualified. What does he run? One of those storefront churches down on the south side?
It's all about having the sing-song voice. Being able to get money from government and spread it around to people you want to give it to—that's the mantra. Only problem is when you become government, then you end up having to like go to Washington and Springfield to try and get money because you can't run your own city. There's a method to this, man. You just—it's like the business of politics. We just don't get it, but it's a business.
Well. business is booming apparently in Chicago, given the confluence of, you know, union money or union influence, federal money, state money, and then whatever local extortion your guys are requiring for businesses to operate down there.
Lou, I have a question for you. Not that my issue should be something we talk about on the air.
By the way, I live in Denver, and we are plagued by our own incompetence. The sanctuary city thing, which I know is affecting you guys too, is coming home here with a vengeance. And we have three gigantic, or they're referred to as migrant encampments as opposed to illegal alien encampments, that are scattered around in the metropolitan area. And so what the city does is they give these guys, I think they give them 60 days in place to find something. You know, these are people who come here with no work permits, no papers, no nothing. And but we asked them to come here. We set it up for them to come here. We made ourselves a sanctuary city, and now they're here, and they've just cut another $10 million off the police budget to dismantle another one of these camps. So they give them 60 days to stay in one place, and then they come in and sweep the place. They scrape up everything, they roust everybody out, flush them out into the city, and then say, okay guys, do your, you know, good luck.
Well, I suggest that the people that I see here, and it's a very narrow group because it's a group right by me, most of them, I see in the morning now, groups walking to the bus, so some of them have gotten a job. And I see a lot at the Home Depot looking to do any kind of work you can't form. And actually, the Home Depot's hire them to help people load stuff in their trucks. I think what I'm saying, Lou, is the people I see, and I'm sure that somewhere buried in the group of people coming across are, you know, villains, thieves, and scoundrels. I mean, any group of people is going to have a few of those. I get that part, but we need to get these people that seem somewhat pure of heart a regular job before they decide they're going to go out and rob the city like all the rest of the people here are doing. And I have a little edge this morning because my garage got broken into last night.
Oh, no.
Well, get a load of this. It is so specific, Lou. And I you know, as everybody knows, I love policemen. My father was one. Somehow or another, our guys are behind the eight ball where people are hacking into something. I took a year and a half ago, right at the near end of COVID, I took a concealed carry class. I never went and got my fingerprints or anything after that. And I do not have a concealed carry gun at all. I do have a FOID card, but I don't have a gun. Well, this is the second time now somebody has broken into my garage with the sole purpose of looking in my glove compartment and under my seat. So somebody, I have Chicago Police memorial plates. Somebody's either watching my plates or somebody has got the list of people that just took a class because they don't care about anything else in the garage. I mean, not that I have anything of value in there, but the guy upstairs has some very expensive bikes and stuff. Nobody wants any of that crap. They check my glove compartment, they check under the seat. Just twice now.
Yeah.
Because obviously most people don't see the part in the class about take the gun in with you and lock it up, that kind of thing. They just leave it in their car, evidently.
Well, this is the fear that I think is quite reasonable for all of us with respect, especially to firearms, but with any personal information. You know, you are one disgruntled or easily bribable clerk away from having your personal information disclosed to the highest bidder. And it's totally crazy. There you remember that tax thing, tax leak of what, 3 or 4 years ago,
yeah,
where some IRS, rogue IRS employee, some, you know, GS2 decided that he was upset about the income inequality in the US. So he said, you know what, I'm just gonna go in and pull all the tax records for Gates and, you know, a bunch of other billionaires, and I'm just going to leak it, you know, put it out there. This is the kind of thing that just, again, we talk about the lack of the lack of confidence in our institutions. We've watched our educational institutions just fold like houses made out of napkins. This is another marker as to why people say, well, I don't trust government because governments, people working in government have agendas and political agendas, and the government doesn't control what, you know, even at the lowest level doesn't control access to this crucial type of information. And in your case, it's dangerous because you've got people looking for guns coming in, you know, coming into your property. And it's horrifically dangerous.
Well, yeah. I mean, plus, if somebody shoots somebody with it, it's going to be my fault, right?
Well, I mean, the issue I've got is they're going to shoot you.
Well,
do you think they're coming into a house where they think there are guns unarmed?
Probably not. Especially if they think it's a policeman in there. Of course, they just shot a policeman 2 weeks ago. We don't seem to care about that either.
Yeah, I want to raise just a couple of topics,
and, go ahead,
and then we can run amok. The first one is this crazy story that the president has decided on his own to withhold aid to a U.S. ally for a personal political advantage, and I'm talking about Donald Trump in Ukraine. No, I'm talking about Joe Biden and what's happening with Israel. I always hearken back. We talked on this program before many years ago about all the plans and the things we anticipate going wrong and, you know, how we plan for contingencies, et cetera, et cetera. And I always noted that foreign policy is the one area where the nature of the person you're electing, you know, makes a huge difference. And we, our domestic situation, we have this huge bureaucratic structure that'll keep things running on a more or less even keel, even if we have an incompetent, mentally deficient person in the White House. But foreign policy is different, because in foreign policy, the other side gets a vote, and we don't have that kind of stabilizing force out there. And this, what's happening, what happened in 2022 with Russia, and what's happening in 2023 with Hamas, is a are classic examples. And I hearken back to Robert Gates, who was Obama's Secretary of Defense, when he said, whatever Joe Biden says with respect to a foreign policy decision, you should be doing the exact opposite, because he has been wrong on every single foreign policy choice he's made since he was a junior senator from Delaware. This is another one. And the point that I want to make, number one, this is an absolutely idiotic foreign policy move with Israel. We're going to cut off Israel. Israel is moving again in self-defense against an existential threat on its border. It's been attacked, had horrible, you know, casualties, and now they're moving to eliminate it. And we tell the and we're concerned about. We ostensibly tell them it's okay to attack Hamas, but you can't attack the innocent civilians, 70% of whom voted for Hamas and still support the October 7th invasion. You can't get those innocent civilians hurt or killed. So what we're going to do is we're going to suspend shipment of precision weapons to you that make it possible for you to conduct your military operations with the kind of precision that we are demanding. So we're going to demand that you conduct precision military operations, and then at the same time, we're going to eliminate the ability for you to do so, or we're going to greatly limit it. That's total idiocy.
Well, there's a million sides to this story, Lou. I mean, a lot of it is anticipation. We set an example that would be different if the Irish and the British were still fighting at each other and blowing people up every few weeks like they were a while ago. Well, when did all that stop, by the way? Was that 20 years ago?
It didn't stop until... I don't think it stopped until into the 90s, right?
Yeah, I'm going to say early 90s, maybe. But it was pretty hot and heavy during the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, the troubles began in the early 70s when the IRA started getting funding from the KGB.
Well, they also started... In what, the 1600s or 1700s?
I mean the actual civil war attack in London, the attacks in Londonderry, the troubles that all ramped up. I mean, it had always been there since Irish independence, but it ramped up when the KGB really started moving in to fund the Sinn Féin and the
IRA. A lot of them get funded from here.
Boston, some, yeah. Yes.
What I'm saying is if you and I were cruising along minding our own business as the head of some university that somehow or another had an awful lot of British and Irish students, and this starts to happen, we're going to sit there and go, it might be time to retire and go fishing. I mean, it's just, there's populations of both sides, and for us to not anticipate that some of this carries over, I can only imagine what it would have been like if you had a university with German and Polish people in it in 1939. I mean, you think...
Yes, there are numerous issues here. I want to focus on what's happening in Gaza.
Well, I guess what the other side of the coin is, and I was talking to an attorney friend of mine last night, is the idea for us to, and I am full for this, Israel's defense, their well-being, the fact that they're an allied, the fact that I support them, is, as you know, you've talked about 100 times, I'm 95% there. However, there are a lot of people, and have a reasonable amount of points, that say that since it's been 2 months and you haven't done anything, right now, if we start giving you stuff to
the reason they haven't done anything is because they've been trying to toe the line we are asking.
Okay,
them
what
to
I'm saying there are people who think now that if you go into this last city full bore, when they don't seem to have any defenses, then they might have some that nobody knows about, that these are not defensive weapons being used. I'm just saying it's a point of view, Lou. It is a point of view, and it's a serious point of view. Now, I'm not saying you're wrong or you're right. I'm just saying.
No. I think, again, we can phrase the issue however we want to phrase it. The short answer is, again, we have an ally conducting an existential, who's involved in an existential fight against an enemy that has basically gone medieval on them with what they've done. And I don't understand the press. I mean, we have 5 U.S. citizens that have either been murdered or are still being held hostage.
I'm just saying that Colin Powell and by you know, you and Mike and other guys around the show, and by the way, I respect you guys 100%. It's clearly a point of view that makes some sense, and it's from one side. But if you take it to the extreme, there might still be a German city out there we haven't bombed yet. And by the way, they voted for the Nazis.
If I thought the Israelis were conducting military operations intentionally in violation of international law, if I thought, for example, that they were acting the way the Russians are acting in Ukraine, I would be saying, fine, cut the weapons off. You know, these people are not conducting military operations in accordance with any recognized standard, but they're not. And I don't. We have to recognize that the Israeli political system is a democracy, and the Israeli political system fully supports by a significant majority.
I think this guy, if this war ends, this guy's out.
Well, but that's not no. We're not talking about Netanyahu. Yeah, he's gone. I think he is gone. We're talking about their war captain, that is running the country right now. This operation.
But I mean, I'm going to say that everything that happened in World War II, I know who George Marshall was, and I know who Roosevelt was. I wouldn't blame a decision on the war cabinet. It's those two guys.
Well, it's not Netanyahu. I will just tell you, it's not Benjamin Netanyahu that's making these decisions. Okay, it is the group of three people, two of whom are from opposition parties, that are involved here. There is widespread support in Israel for this operation, and it, as I said, it's being conducted in a reasonable manner.
Well,
the first point I want to make is what he's doing. To the extent that we want to say we want to protect innocent civilians, what he's doing is counterproductive to that. It runs counter to that goal. That's number one.
Well, I'm just saying there are people, and again, we're not going to solve this issue, but there are people who at this point see the score, for lack of a better term, the score is being Palestinians 2,000, as horrible as that is, Israelis 20+, and think that's good enough. There are people who think that way. I mean, it's just...
I know, that's irrelevant. That viewpoint, I think, is pretty irrelevant. But that's, I understand that viewpoint. I mean, I get it. You know, I understand that a significant amount of it is motivated by anti-Semitism. So I'm going to acknowledge that too. My point is, from a practical matter, what he's doing runs counter to the goals that he's expressed. So that's point number one. Point number two, and I'm sort of looking at the details here, but this is exactly what Donald Trump got impeached for, isn't it?
Well, yeah. they're all in the same boat. That's what Roosevelt would have got impeached for if they knew what he was doing.
There are obviously different. The situations are different, and some people would say, "Well, you know, that was a Donald Trump personal thing with Biden, and he was trying to damage him." Or whatever, and I could make a pretty good case. Well, you know, President Trump thought that national security was being damaged by these undercutting these arrangements they had with Ukraine, and that there was high level corruption going on. I thought that was a legitimate purpose for the investigation. Regardless, we have congressionally authorized funds that are being shut down by.
They're being
a president for a personal political advantage.
They're being what I think what the man is, you know, I don't know what the hell he's trying to say, Lou. I mean, you and I, you
don't,
have a,
don't quote Joe Biden.
Yeah, I'm saying, but you have, put it this way, you have an enormous ego when it comes to the law because you deserve to have one. You're really good at it. I have an enormous ego knowing about the history of trading and to helping people out with their portfolios because I deserve to have one. But that's as far as it goes for you and me. These politicians, they're just different, Lou.
I'm just convinced that
whatever they have to do to keep them as in office is so important to the world that they'll do anything they have to do. It's a whole different ego step than you and I have.
I do. I agree with you, and that's one of the many reasons that I was I recognized early on that I was totally unsuitable for politics. But what is your, I'm just interested in your perspective, and Greg's for that matter, and anybody else's, on this issue.
I try and put myself in the other guy's place. I'm trying to be Vito Corleone without killing people. I'm willing to give these people, meaning these people, the Jewish state, anything they need to do to survive.
No.
But I'm saying at some point.
What about this Biden decision?
My point is, somewhere along the line here, I'm giving them for a reason. The reason is to protect themselves. If I think that they're going to use my stuff for something I think is not really protecting themselves and is unnecessary, whether this is the line or not, I don't know. But somewhere there's a line there. Now,
okay, right. Now, what I want you to do is take the more cynical worldview, which... You know,
oh, believe
really
me, I can do that. I can do that.
Yeah, I know. You're really good at that. And Greg is too. I want the more cynical worldview of, oh my God, this is the Biden people in the White House looking out the window, thinking, oh my God, Flint, Michigan, and every other place like Flint, Michigan, with a high Muslim population, is going to vote against us or stay home because we are backing Israel. And so we need to try to walk this line where we sort of slip them weapons on the sly, but we tell them publicly, you guys are bad people, and we're not gonna play in your game. And
that's more likely.
Yeah, well, how do we know
that? I think that's, I agree. So if you think that, then this move by Biden, I think, becomes indistinguishable from that of Donald Trump.
My thought background here, Lou, is very similar in that this particular, I don't see Hamas and the Israelis sitting down and coming up with a deal without somebody from the outside saying,
there's
hey, you guys, you better take a deal because we're not supporting it anymore. I think we're going to have to do that, Lou, and I think we're going to have to do that in Ukraine.
This was the deal. Just now, it was the deal. That's there's right. enough time for the dude to get out of from under the tunnel network. He's going to leave, and then they're going to go back to.
Hamas. Part of the reason, and again, I want to go back to my original question: is this like what Trump got impeached for? I think it's almost indistinguishable. But
which time? I thought he got impeached for the women.
No. He got impeached. He got impeached first time because of the phony call or phony case that got generated about him supposedly threatening to cut off aid for Ukraine.
What makes you think that he's not just saying it and they can use him wherever they feel like?
Well, supposedly we're cutting the weapons off.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Why do you believe that? I think we're basically saying is don't attack that city.
Because it's an incredibly dangerous thing for him to do. It emboldens Hamas, for one thing. And number two, it eliminates the ability of the Israelis, or limits the ability of the Israelis, to restrict collateral damage. So now instead of dropping what are called small diameter bombs, a 250-pound weapon that has a relatively low explosive charge that is highly accurate, instead of using those, we're going to be dropping 2,000-pound bombs on people.
I think there's a group that says, we got the port ready to go, although it's still not open.
Oh, by the way, they shelled. The Hamas and showing how just, you know, totally nuts they are. They shelled the shoreline facilities where that dock is going to be attached. They shelled that yesterday.
It's unreal.
No, it's not. It's perfectly well, consistent.
But you've got people. Who the hell even knows who these people are? They could be people from Iran, Houthis. Do we even know who the hell they are that are doing this stuff? I mean, we like to put
fighters,
the name Hamas on it.
The fighters that are in Gaza are pretty much the people that were in Gaza when the Israelis sealed the place.
Well, look at what happened. What's happening in Syria? And you and I were talking. We blamed every single we blamed every single bullet on the one group. It turns out there's 10 groups.
Gaza is not bad.
I don't. How do you tell the players without a scorecard over there? I guess is my question. I mean, the guys who are running it can't even be there, are they? The guys that are
Sinwar is still in Gaza, they believe. Let me put it this way: the safest place for Sinwar right now is where Joe Biden is protecting him, and that's Gaza. If Sinwar gets out of Gaza and goes to Doha or some other Arabic safe house somewhere, the Israelis will kill him, and he knows that. The safest place for him right now is, as I said, where Joe Biden is protecting him, and that's in Gaza.
Well, I have to believe.
And anyway, that.
We got a dash to break here, Luna. S&P futures down 10.50, NASDAQ futures down 50. Earnings last night are Airbnb, whack, down about 10%. Some earnings have been good, some have been lousy, but that's one that's been lousy. We'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 10, NASDAQ futures down 48. We had a real inside day yesterday, a real slow day. We haven't had a down day in a while, though. We'll see today. We've been down a couple of mornings, but then we come right back. The buy the dip is definitely back in vogue, at least up until the last couple of days. We're in Europe, we got the DAX up 83.4%, FTSE up 37.4%, kick around shirking a little bit, only up 10.1%. Bank of England holds rates steady. They keep saying that they're convinced that inflation is going to take a huge turn down, so they'll be able to lower them. But by the way, it hasn't taken a turn down yet. They're just convinced it's going to take a turn down. Maybe we should wait for it to happen. Nikkei down 128.3%. Hang Seng up 223, over 1% and 1.2. Japan real wages dropped for the 24th straight month. Boy, it sounds like here, doesn't it? Shanghai up 25 bucks, 0.8%. So the Chinese government leaking money in. Russell's allegedly buying a lot of gold. I don't know about that, but allegedly they are. Yesterday is a review. Dow was up 172. We've had individual stocks in the Dow shooting up. But S&P was down 3 cents. Yeah, 3 cents. NASDAQ down 29, so you can see what kind of a dud it was for traders yesterday. Bonds up 3 basis points, 4.51. The Bund up 3 basis points, 2.49. So the rundown after the Powell meeting seems to have consolidated a little bit. Now it's creeping back up a little bit. Japan up 4 basis points, 0.92. Now, that's the highest we've seen that in a really long time. Oil up 64 cents, but still under 80 bucks, 79.63. Brent up 62 cents, 84.20. Natural gas down 2 cents, 2.16. RBOB up 2 cents, 2.55. We've got gold is down 3 bucks, 23.19. Silver up 31 cents, 27.91. It's over 1%. Copper down a penny, 452. We got foreign exchange, the euro at 107. So the dollar has been stronger, but been kind of flat lately. British pound, same spot, 1.25. And we've got Bitcoin down another 1,200 bucks, 60,998. I guess in danger of going under 60,000 if this another day like that. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. It's raining again.
Yep. Morning, everyone. 6:35 here in Chicago. 59 degrees, rain, and travel warning for drivers today. Phoenix, 64. It's a high of 88 there today. Warm and sunshine there. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 27 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook is 54 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 41 minutes. The Dan Ryan from 95th is 25 minutes. And the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 36 minutes. NBA. Knicks beat the Pacers at home. That was 121 to 130. Baseball. Cubs lose to the Padres at Wrigley. That was 3-0. Diamondbacks win 4-3 against the Reds. And the White Sox are one away from double-digit wins for the season. The White Sox beat the Rays 4-1. And in NHL, Panthers slaughter the Bruins. It was 6-1 at home. And a close one for the Canucks coming back in the third, 5-4. That's all I got, Chief.
I left the very loud Tripoli tap when it was 1-1. I guess I left at the right time and probably turned into the Tripoli wake.
It was a lot. I mean, it was high scoring, 5-4. I mean,
on one hand, I want the Bruins to win so my buddy Nick and Tiff and the gang can get a few more huge nights. On the other hand, I'm so tired of that crowd. They don't call them mass holes for nothing. Just saying. Anyway, Lou, on that note, hey,
By the way, the Colorado Avalanche are proceeding into the second round. Denver Nuggets, not quite so well.
Boy, how good is this Minnesota team?
Pretty doggone good.
Yeah. Why exactly, when the Sox couldn't wait to give Dylan Cease away, and no matter what, they were just going to give him away for a bag of balls, why didn't the Cubs enter that derby? The guy's a terrific pitcher. I liked him when he was on the Sox. Seems like a decent enough guy. Now he's mowing him down for San Diego. What is with these people?
Well, okay, so roster assembly is an art rather than a science. By the way, I'm going to make a hat tip to the Pittsburgh Pirates, of all people, who did not wait until after the contract year expired for this Paul Skeens kid, who is an Air Force Academy product, although he was only there 2 years and then went to LSU. Number one draft pick in all of baseball.
Yeah,
last
he's supposed
year.
To be real good.
And I just he's one of those guys. You know, every now and then you're at the academy with somebody who's most of the guys there were athletes in high school. So it's a very athletically sort of focused kind of population. And there's a lot of kids who did a lot of stuff in high school. You know, they were all football players and wrestlers and basketball, baseball players. Every now and then somebody would come along and you would just go, uh-oh, this guy is way above everybody else here. It's much like what happens, Tom, when you're playing with an NFL caliber person in high school. Everybody looks around and goes, wait a minute, this guy's like head and shoulders above everybody else. And that's the way this Skeens kid was at Air Force. He came in, and the Mountain West, they did not know what to do with him in the Mountain West. I mean, he was, that is not a baseball conference, and he was just...
What does he play? What was he, a position player or pitcher?
He's a pitcher.
Okay.
He's a pitcher, and he's throwing 100 miles an hour in college. And he starts just cutting people apart. And
well, he would me, that's for sure. I couldn't hit that thing.
So this is a marker of how things work. You know, at the end of his second year, at the end of your second year is when you get your service commitment. And so if he stays past a certain point after his second year, he is committed to the Air Force for at least 5 years.
Didn't that used to be freshman year?
No, it's always been second class or third class at the end of your third class year. Anyway, he you know, schools start talking to him, and his parents go to the academy baseball coach, and they say, what do you think? And the academy baseball coach, to his everlasting credit, said, look, this kid would make a fantastic Air Force officer, and I would be sorry to lose him, but this is a once-in-a-lifetime talent he's got. I would tell him to transfer, go to a school where he's going to be able to turn pro without any question, and develop. And so he transfers to LSU with the academy's, I won't say with the academy's blessing, because they never like to lose somebody like that, but with the athletic department's understanding that we are not the place for this kid. This is where he belongs. He goes to LSU, just, you know, does the same thing there. He was in the AAA. They're calling him up now from AAA. His ERA is below one. He's pitched, I think, 30 innings. Wow. His ERA is below one.
Wow.
He's got something like 45 or 50 strikeouts. And yeah, if you watch him pitch, he's scary.
So we're talking about another Kerry Wood, basically.
Sort of looks that, he sort of looks that way. With a faster fastball. I think he's 6'4", 6'5".
Wow.
He's big. And you know, big long arm and big, you know, he's got kind of a Ron Jeremy mustache though that I'm not fond of. But he's being called up. So
what's with you attorney dude? My attorney guy was having a drink with last night. He goes, I really like this Dylan Cease, but I could never handle a mustache.
comment.
Wow.
So, just a note on that. We'll see. So the question, of course, now is, what's Pittsburgh going to do with him? Can they build a staff and a rotation around him and maybe get back? You know, who knows? But he is, if he's managed properly and doesn't hurt himself, he is that kind of talent.
Lou, how is it that people who have played a lot of sports, and I didn't play at your level, but every single day I did something. I was in a basketball league, I was playing handball, I was doing something. And how is it that a lot of people don't recognize how good these people that make it to the top of that chain really are? I mean, most people play sports because they really enjoy playing them. They love the competition. And by the way, you'd like to be good, and you work out, you get as good as you can. But how is it people don't just... I'm actually feeling good enough, right? Next couple of weeks I might go play some Sunday softball again. But I played softball my whole life, and I played with some really good ball players. We actually had a guy on our team who was drafted off our softball team by the Yankees, where he was out of school and was drafted off the softball team, but he was drafted during the season, which cost me a serious outfielder. But when you see somebody that's that much better on a Sunday softball, these two brothers come out and they're like 25-ish. Lou, you can't not notice them. They got the best arm. They're the fastest guys. They hit the ball the furthest. They do everything well. The guy can throw it from right field to third base like an aspirin tablet, for God's sake. The two brothers, they both got recruited by Florida State, and they said, nah, we're going to stay home, and they're like, I'll get a regular job. They've won at a young age, from 20, they've keyed the national champions like 4 years in a row, which nobody's ever done before in 16-inch softball. I didn't show you this article that sent the other day. Remember back in the Bulls' glory days, the guy at the end of the bench that everybody used to make fun of, Dickie Simpkins?
I remember the name.
But he never even made the playoff roster, but he was on the roster for the season. The question was, how good are these guys? And this guy goes, you know, I played on the South Side, and in the summer, Dickie Simpkins used to come play with us. He goes, he was 6'9", 275. Hands are as big as anybody could palm anybody's head. We had to make the guy promise to not score, just so the teams would be even in 4-on-4, but he couldn't shoot. He was that much better than any other person we ever saw, and people thought he sucked. He didn't suck.
It's to get the culling process that goes on in a professional sports league is, again, unless you've played at a high level, or unless you've played with people who are that kind of talent, you really don't have a feel for it. So I was lucky enough. I mean, pro football, I was lucky enough to have a family in pro football. So I saw some unbelievable athletes. But that was for observing. Getting up to compete against them, I was lucky enough to swim in a high school, to be on a swim team with two Olympians. One was a guy and one was a girl. So the girl trained with us because there was nobody in her, you know, in the girls' team that was even close to her. The guy was a backstroker who actually, you know, made the Olympic team back in 1980 when we pulled the plug on the Summer Olympics. But the minute you got into the water with these people, you started realizing just how special they were. You watched, you know, I mean, I used to look at John, this guy's name was John Prince, and I was bigger, I was stronger. I mean, I could bench press more, I could pick up more weight. I could certainly, you know, out wrestle him or whatever. And I thought, you know, I watched him in the water and I thought, I can take this guy. You know, it's just a question of practice. I can get there. And after about 6 months of training at a fairly high level and watching him just effortlessly pass me on races or in events, I understood what I was dealing with. And that's, well,
his body style had to be different. His feet were bigger compared to his body. Like, what's just, his name? I mean, just, well, and, just designed and for just, swimming.
Yeah, and just one of those, you know, the heart and cardiovascular system combination, and combined with, and this is crucial. You know this. There's a lot of guys out there with superb athletic talent who don't have it upstairs, who don't have the will, don't have the whatever to push it far enough to take full advantage of it. John did. John was one of the mentally toughest people I knew, although he almost, you know, he came across as this goofy, you know, high school kid. But you put him in the water and he was a killer and absolutely focused. And so my father, the pro football coach, had, you know, comes to my swim meets, and after about the third meet he goes, who's John, you know, introduce me to John, because John looks like he's got the mentality of the people that I work with every day.
Wow.
And so we sit down and talk, and how do you recognize that? I think you actually have to see it to suddenly realize that, you know what, no matter how much you practice, you're never going to be as good as this guy. And that's a great understanding to get, you know, early on in life, that there are some people that you just sort of step back and say, hey brother, you got it, go.
Well, yeah. Hey, on a sort of a similar note, where I was privy to a few conversations. I sent you that thing yesterday, the kid from Chicago. Have you opened it or not?
Yeah, the NIL, the kid that left, kid that got recruited out of what? High school there,
yeah.
Ohio State.
Yeah, let's not name the high school, but
right.
Yeah, and then at the last minute, the huge bid came in for somebody else. I guess my question is, I know you, at least I don't think you're an official agent anymore, but without talking out of school, who's representing these people? They're not, or is the phone just ringing? I'm going to say in their house, but nobody's a home phone anymore. Evidently the school he ended up going to for some exorbitant amount per month. How is that alumni money? We don't know which group it is. I guess the question everybody all week, Kevin and I have been talking about, and I wanted to ask you, the contract that people used to sign for the NCAA scholarship, I think was pretty much universal through the system, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Now, as we speak, and I was talking to my buddy Bill last night, he goes, it has to be being changed as we have this beer. There's no way people are going to commit to somebody for a year or two and have them get scooped away from somebody else without some sort of a labor contract where you got to be here for a while. And by the way, if
those contracts, as far as I know, those contracts have not changed. The portal process is wide open. Now, I think this will change, Tom, but the portal process is wide open. There are no commitments. The only thing that's holding these kids in place is the you know, whatever sense of I made a promise and I'm going to try to keep it, and the chance of, you know, playing with a bunch of people you like, and the NIL.
Well, from an economic standpoint, and I actually think I'm pretty good at this, just looking at the economic picture, and I can't tell you when or who or whatever, the timing is lousy, but I pretty much can tell you where this is heading. And if a school, for instance, we haven't done this at all, I don't think, but if Notre Dame says, you know what, I'm going to stop recruiting these high school kids, I'm tired of flying around these people's private jets, and I'm tired of talking to their dumb parents, we're not going to do that anymore. We're just going to open up the portal, or maybe we'll get five high school kids a year that we think are four and five stars.
That's what Deion Sanders is doing here in Colorado.
Yeah, well, I'm saying I didn't think of it. I mean, I'm just, now the schools that are still doing it, I'll use the term Miami of Ohio because I know a kid here went there. They're going to spend the 40, 50 grand per kid going back and forth, flying whatever family members and stuff back and forth, and they're going to pay that, and they're going to coach this kid for 2 years while maybe he grows, and all of a sudden they thought he was a two-star, now he's a four-star, and Notre Dame just snags him.
That's what's happening.
I understand.
Just so you know, that's what's happening at Air Force right now. Air Force's basketball team is being cut to pieces because they've developed two or three kids that are really good, and they're gone.
Right. What I'm saying is that will not last. There will be some compensation. There will be something. The contract the kid signs is going to be for some amount of money. I mean, the amount of money the kid we're talking about, no way I'm signing that kid to a standard contract. If I'm going to pay him that kind of money as a freshman, he better friggin' be here as a junior.
Well, that's we talked about this during the bowl season to a minor extent, where you had kids dropping out because they don't want to get a risk of injury playing in that last bowl game.
Did anybody drop out who was in the Final Four? I don't think so. Maybe it might have been somebody.
No. It's more of a football thing than it is basketball. But. Somebody drops out, and I said, you know, if I'm paying this kid NIL money, I put in the contract that he's got to play all the way through the season to include any bowl games. And if he doesn't, then the NIL contract voids, and that money is forfeited.
Well, I'm going to say that.
This is becoming, we are moving very rapidly, probably faster than anybody thought, to a mercenary semi-pro league where these kids are just playing for money.
Well, they're there. Some of the bigger
schools. To a certain extent, it's always been that way, but it's out in the open now.
Do you think AAU could ever challenge the NCAA?
Yep.
Well, especially not in football.
Especially in the off... Well, the NCAA in football, Tom, almost doesn't exist anymore.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, football is going
to move,
I think.
Sounds like we should bring it back.
Yeah, well, I think football is going to move very quickly to in college, to a non-NCAA 64, I think 64 team super league that has four 16 team conferences with eight sub conferences, and they just play off against each other. That's your bowl game.
I'm going to agree with disagree. I'm going to agree with that, except the number is not going to be 64. I think it's going to be less. Just saying, I want you, before I give mine.
Got to fill those bowl games with something.
Oh no, but you know what, Lou? If I played however many games I'm playing as a senior, and I played there for 4 years, and I think I'm going to go get drafted, I don't need a month later to go play in the toilet bowl somewhere. What do I need to do that for? It's because ESPN have 4 hours on TV.
Because your semi-pro league requires it.
Well, okay, but I'm saying that just so the flaming idiot coach gets two more weeks of practice. I mean, what are we doing here? Nobody wants to go. You can't even get the parents to go, for God's sake.
Oh, I mean, I understand that. Let me throw two things out.
All right, before you do that, I haven't asked you your opinion on this, and I want to because you're the guy who's I value the most. I've been looking at somebody's schools and their budgets and things like that. And just their heart, you know. And Kevin and I have been kicking around how many people are flying through this portal, how many people it must. He's up to, you know, he'll text me if I give him the wrong. He's up to 15 people minimum at Notre Dame, maybe 20. Recent now cuts back if you recruited the kid in high school and you know all about him. I mean, he would say that if he was here. That there are full time portal. I bet there's more people doing that than working for the Bears looking at people, because there is at least, you know where they all are. And every single one of these kids, before you even look at them in the portal, before you ring the phone at them, you've got to formulate what your bid is going to be, because that seems to be what's going on. I'm going to say this is
I think we could be really good at this. I'm just saying.
Yeah, we could be pretty good. Yeah, but I'm saying this is how many schools want that. I look at, you know, I keep looking at UCLA. I use them as my example. It's the one I looked up. Look, their budget is $11 billion. They want this piss-ass stuff going on so they can make another 10 or 15 on football and then go to a conference, and all of a sudden your other people get. Why even think about that? I mean, I'm going to say I'll bet Boston College is not in that group. I'm saying Northwestern is not in that group. Irish, not so sure. Indiana, I mean, at some point, you know, the idea of running this semi-pro sponsored team so the people at university can go party and make it feel like their appendage grew an inch, there's a limit to that. There's a reason why in Europe you just say, if you want to play soccer, go play with the soccer people. I mean, they better not push too far is all I'm saying, and I think they are.
We'll see. But, you know, every college president will tell you who's involved in fundraising and keeping that endowment going, will tell you that there's nothing that succeeds like having a winning football or basketball team and to get the alumni coming in and throwing money at you.
There's a lot of schools. University of Chicago dumped the team, and for the last 100 years they've had as much money as anybody else.
No.
Well, the Irish used to be, you had to pour them all kinds of money just to get in the ticket lottery. Now people are saying, screw it. That's dropping.
That may be the case, but the football eyeballs, TV eyeballs, are driving the train here.
I'm not saying it's. I'm sure there's an awful lot of people that watch UCLA football that graduated from UCLA. And if I went to UCLA, and so did you, we'd find that Saturday afternoon we'd meet up and have a beer and watch the game. I get it. I'm one of those guys. But at some level, you're going to say. Right now, I don't think Notre Dame football is worth it at this point. It's beyond me.
Yeah, no, I get it. I mean, it's one of sort of the refreshing things about being out here in the Mountain West, where we don't really have a power football program in the conference, and you know, you go to games for the enjoyment of the games. You know, none of our kids, very few of our kids, are gonna go to the pros. You go to the game to watch the football game, enjoy the experience, and in my case, criticize the offensive line play.
But Lou, if I appointed you to a university board, and you're sitting there, and you've got this research project, this, you got this student, you got a million things to take care of, and you got all kinds of stuff going on. You got 20,000 people there. All of a sudden, some mo comes in and says, you know, here's the football budget. We've got 40 people. We got to pay this kid this and that. By the way, we need 3 private jets at our disposal so we can go and see their family. You're going to sit there and go, I don't want any part of this. What does this got to do with what I'm doing?
I know. And yet, a winning football program is something that people in a lot of places can build around, especially in places like the Southeast Conference, the old Pac-10, the Big Ten. I mean, it's just the way... That's our priority. Those are our priorities.
But what do you think? What do you think the net is? I mean, Alabama has this great program, and now what's his name? This guy quit because he doesn't like this new business at all. But so he quits, and now Alabama. I'm going to say, Alabama football has been accretive to Alabama. I'm with you. I mean, I'm no way going to debate you on that one. But now, what about another school in the conference that may have hired some coach for a gazillion dollars? He doesn't win, and they fire him. They have to pay him $30 million, and then they go get another guy. The coaches that are, or the schools that are trying to get to the top, how much are they pissing away?
I don't think it's an efficient use of money. If that's what you're getting at. By the way, Kevin just sent us an article.
Why isn't it an efficient use of money?
NIL-driven Las Vegas college basketball event with millions paid to schools is nearly finalized. The Players Era Festival, 8 teams in 2024, expected to double to 16 teams, huge brands, and it's all being run by NIL money.
Why isn't it an efficient use of money?
To pay a coach $30 million to leave?
Yeah. I'm just saying that from the athletic budget perspective, I'm sure there's a lot because there was, under the old system that I was aware of, there's a lot of leakage. That's why I say it's not an efficient use of money.
The expenses grow to meet the revenue, like in any business.
Yeah.
The business of college is being A, a hedge fund, and B, having a good sports team for more recruiting.
Well, that's what...
Well, no, actually, the business of college is to produce a bunch of anti-American social activists.
Well, that's only the Ivy League.
Yeah.
I'm afraid it's a lot.
It's all over.
Than that.
But there's not enough idiots.
You got a bunch of boys. You got a bunch of those boys and girls at Northwestern.
At the state schools,
Chicago.
There's too many poor people. They can't convince them.
Well,
you're not seeing these kinds of demonstrations is at the trade colleges.
Trade colleges don't do that. The majority of pretty much everybody. This is just a certain.
Well, it's not. It's not just something. It's you know, people have. If like I said earlier, if you have a school that had the French and Germans in it in 1940, you got a problem. If all of a sudden there's a war there, and if you have a school that has Jewish people and Palestinian people, how are they not pissed off at each other?
I don't think there's a lot of Palestinians at Columbia.
How many does it take?
There's a lot of Jewish
people.
There are
because Qatar and a number and Saudi and a number of other places have dumped mega bucks.
That's
into
just
those
money,
programs
though.
to bring anti-Western, anti-American folks in. Mr. Janitas is in the queue. I see. I'm going to check off. You guys have a great week, Tom.
By the way, did you guys get snow last week? Or was that the Sierra Nevada? Is that a winter storm?
No, they got about 14 inches of snow up at Breck 2 days ago. I'm going to be out next week, all next week. So I'll try to make arrangements with you. On the sly here.
All right. We'll double up on you the week after or something.
Fair enough.
All right, buddy. You take care of yourself. Have a nice time. Were you leaving? Are you vacay or business?
No, business. Bozeman.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Yep. Good. All right. Have a good time doing business. SP Futures down 9. NASDAQ Futures down 41. Be right back. Dan Janitas.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures down 8, NASDAQ Futures down 37. Do we have Professor Dan?
Yeah, I am here.
How are you, buddy?
Good. How are you?
Doing all right. I'm hanging in here. You know, we got a beautiful day yesterday. Now we're back into the rain. We've had enough rain. If you're a a farmer in yesterday. You and I, I'm surprised. Well, Greg was not here. We talked a lot, especially with him and some with you, about futures contracts and selling futures forward and stuff. And if you have a corn crop and soybean crop, but you also have to be careful that something crazy doesn't happen to you, right? Like a local flood or a hailstorm. Got a perfect example of that. I haven't had a chance to tell Greg yet. Is Audrey and I, she drags me out to, I wanted to go out too. So we go to this place way the hell down south where they got the best flowers, blah, blah, blah. So she, of course, gets her stuff when she likes to do flowers in the yard. And I get a whole bunch of tomato plants and she likes to do the herbs. So we got all that stuff, the basil and everything. Well, in Orland, from like Plainfield to Midway on Tuesday, we had this incredible hailstorm. And it shredded the crap out of the stuff we just bought backyard. So I can only imagine if you're a corn farmer and you just sold futures because your crop was in the ground and it was growing and it looked pretty good, and all of a sudden you're shredded and you got no corn. I can't even imagine what's going through that guy's mind, because I'm pissed that my tomatoes are gone. They're only like $5. Because I gotta go get them again. Can you imagine that happening? Because that happens to people. You would never sell, I don't think, all the futures, or you would buy some puts or something instead. I don't know how you could possibly. That's why you have crop insurance, I guess. But can you imagine that sort of thing happening, sitting there going, "Why me? What'd I do?" But it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always think of cars. With hailstorms. Yeah, that's. I've known several cars. Fortunately, not one of mine, but I've known several people who've had cars that would. Damaged, in some cases damaged pretty seriously because of hail.
What was the I'm gonna test your memory. What was the hurricane that walked into, was it Charlotte or one of the big city in Carolina? Was it Hugo or something? One of them.
Hugo was in Charleston, yeah.
Yeah, it went in there. It was one of the first modern real damage hurricanes. I mean, one went through Homestead.
Yes.
There was nothing in Homestead.
Homestead was Andrew back in 92.
But before Hugo, which probably was in the 80s, but the biggest insurance event ever was a massive hailstorm in Orlando where they had to replace like 200,000 cars or something.
Amazing.
Lou says they have hail events in Denver all the time. It costs insurance companies fortunes on cars.
That's why there are garages.
You'd never buy a flood damaged vehicle, but. If it wasn't too bad, if you're just buying a pickup truck to drive around, and I could see myself buying a hail damaged pickup. Unless it looked like somebody hit it with machine guns, maybe it does. But anyway, how big of a hail do you got to be to dent your car? It's got to be like pretty darn big, doesn't it?
It's got to be. I mean, you hear golf ball size hail, and I assume a golf ball size hail would do some pretty serious damage.
Not to mention to your head. I mean, if you're outside,
to your head as well. You'll be wearing a hard hat, right?
All right, so Dan, what I wanted to ask you today, I'm sure you have stuff to talk about as well, which of course we will do. What do you make of, the Fed is letting money drain off the balance sheet, okay? They're also, the money supply is actually up a little bit in the last year, so, and money supply can move up and down. That's why it's their job to maintain it at a certain level. So I think they're kind of just letting it go, and it's growing a little on its own, but not a lot, but a little bit. Certainly not fighting inflation decrease or anything like that. But it's creeping a little. And then you see these other countries, like China and Japan, throwing money into the system, and then they're buying a lot of gold too. Supposedly China is. Who the hell knows where they are? They aren't. But that's what I was reading last night. How much of that leaks in? In other words. Because everybody, you look around and the inflation doesn't look like it's stopping that much here. And then Britain today came out and said, by the way, we're convinced that in the next month or two inflation's going to come crashing down, but by the way, it hasn't yet. How much of this is BS? How much of it is, if you put money in anywhere in the world, does it creep into somebody else's a little bit? I mean, what do you make of that?
I think that's a very good question. It hits a couple of the points that I was going to highlight today as well. Just that, if you think of years ago, like in my early days of managing money, we were very U.S.-centric, although we did talk about what was going on overseas, and we did see global economy becoming also a place of, you know, the global financial markets, the global economy were becoming more and more important. What's interesting, Chief, is that since COVID, there's been this little bit of divergence from that. And what's happened is several countries, including Sweden and Mexico, just this past week, have actually cut rates because the situation that they're seeing is one with less inflation. So there's two countries that are cutting rates where we're not doing that, where we're still seeing inflation. So I think the point that you make is quite good in that how much global, you know, are we moving more towards this truly global society, or have we become a little more insulated here and focus on the U.S.? Well, the one thing I'll say is that the U.S. has, one of the things we've done over the last 4 or 5 years is we've really focused on our economic growth. There's been a lot less talk, if you've noticed, about the interactions, our interactions, say, with Europe, with Asia, with China. China, some of the issues have been geopolitical. Some of them have been geopolitical in the Middle East. However, it seems that we've entered a period of time, I don't think this is going to be a long-lasting period of time, but a period of time where there are different economic environments in each country across the globe, and that's impacting the inflation and therefore going to impact what happens with rates, with trade, with you know, the level of risk in each of these countries. So it has changed. I think that's a great question. And right now, I think here in the States, we are still in this sort of flattish mode where we're going to see higher rates for a while, no chance of a rate cut. But other countries, I mean, Japan is raising rates, and Japan's situation has been entirely different than ours. There has not been a delinking from China. Maybe in some people's minds, we should be with the whole talk with TikTok and all that. But I still think trade is still very large there. Now, one other thing that we've talked about and that we all know is that our dependence on oil within the U.S., you know, as opposed to relying on Russia, relying on the Middle East, relying on Venezuela, that has changed. And I believe, in my opinion, that that's a good thing, that independence that we moved towards. And it wasn't, some of it was intentional and some of it wasn't. But it's created a world now where we're really taking a close look at what's going on here in the U.S. versus the interconnection so much with other countries. So this has been a phenomenon that I think is going to be not necessarily short-lived, but it's a period of a phase that we're going through, or a trend that we're going through right now. One other way that we're seeing this is through the purchase of foreign securities by U.S. investors. So though there are people who will be out there buying their favorite Chinese stock, since we have had a very strong financial market, both in stocks and bonds in recent years, most U.S. investors have focused on U.S. securities. We're not quite at that point where we're looking overseas and saying, you know, let's buy some Swedish bonds. It just, you know, there are some managers that are doing that, but in general, I think we've become more U.S. focused, more U.S. centric in the last couple of years.
Well, I guess if you really want to go into that, boy, this would be, we could do this in a graduate class, Dan, but I don't know if we want to do it on the air. If you did a real stock and flow analysis of the money entering the system in all different places, let me put it this way. Two things that are kind of different in the world between us and the people on TV. I'm not saying they're idiots or not, because obviously they're making a lot of money doing what they're doing. So when you and I say rates, the feds might cut rates because of something, something, inflation drops a little bit, you and I are talking about 5.5 to maybe 4 or 3.75, a normal rate where maybe the 10-year is still 5 or 6, like it probably always was, or should, well, I won't say should be, but people that are 35 years old, when they start talking about cutting rates, they're talking about going back to 1.5 and justifying these market prices and even pushing them even higher. That I don't think happens. You know, but it could. But the other point is, when you start talking about investing overseas and back and forth. I mean, you and I know, and I guess since you brought it up, I'll blame you. Since you brought it up, it's not a one-step transaction.
Right.
It's a two-step right. transaction. You could make the argument, and I'm not going to do it now because I don't want you to tell me I'm nuts. You could make the argument that in the last 4 years since COVID, the market is not even up. The dollar's down. The dollar, there's 40% more dollars in the system, which is the same as a half a stock split, basically, and we're up 40% in the stock. So the stocks in relation to other stuff have not even gone up. Certainly, you know what I'm saying? One equal, but that's not the way we think. And I'm not going to expect people to understand what I'm talking about, but that's not the way we normally think, but that's essentially what happened. But now, so now if you and I want to invest in the Swedish market, and we say, wow, in terms of the Swedish currency, they haven't gone up. Well, maybe their currency hasn't been deflated like ours. So if we decide to go and buy the Swedish currency, invest in the stock, now all of a sudden if they flood their market and their stock balloons up, we think we're making money on the stock, but when we come back to turn their currency into dollars, we find we haven't made a dime.
Right.
So, you know, you sort of have to be careful when people start talking about you should buy this foreign, and I'm not saying you did, but we should buy Chinese stocks. Like you'll see guys on TV say all the time, wait a minute. What if those guys, devalue the yuan by 40%? I mean, say it was Mexico, right? 40%, just an exaggerated number. That thing better be up 40%, or you're not even even, right?
Yes.
Well, I mean, just in our conversation, even with our listeners, which are pretty darn high on an intellectual scale, if you and I just said that on national TV, would we have gotten the gong or a hook?
I'm not sure.
I'm thinking we would have. I think we would have.
May have. Yeah, we may have. There'd certainly be questions, no question about it. I think there's been a trend, there's been a change from where we were in 2019 pre-COVID to where we are today in terms of the globalization. And there, you know, even in the media, that, as you mentioned earlier, that if you listen to, you know, most of the media, you're not hearing quite as much about the interaction between what's going on here and what's going on, say, in Australia, or what's going on in the Middle East. One thing, you know, I watch Bloomberg, and even at night when they have the Asia show and they're talking about what's going on there, they talk about it in a very different way than they have in recent years. They talk about it in isolation. Here are the political events going on here. Here's what's going on with their yield curve. Here's what's going on with their politics and some particular companies. You're not hearing as much about the integration with the other states, especially, and with the other countries, especially the United States. So there seems to me to have been a marked change since we, you know, have ended this pandemic period. I believe that's going to come back. I think it's going to come back slowly, however.
Well, okay, now you mentioned every country is probably a different story. But,
yes.
But clearly China, politically, I mean, if you take it from, let's go back 10 years, there was no, God, they mentioned China on TV as much as they mentioned AI now.
Yes.
It was an absolute open game. That if maybe, yes. Maybe I'll put a factory here, maybe I'll put it there, maybe I'll expand there. By the way, how much are they? They're hitting me up for $3 an hour, not even that, $2 an hour for wages over there, maybe not even that. But it costs me this much back and forth. I'll put this factory in China. Or nah, this one, you know, the transfer back and forth of materials. I mean, for God's sake, we grow the cotton here. We ship the cotton to China. We make the blue jeans there and have to ship it back. So, I mean, your labor has to be pretty damn cheap for you to make up for all that stuff, right? So
absolutely.
So, but that was a wide open game. And right now, politically, I don't know that with the risks going on there, I don't think it's wide open anymore. It's not. You and I, if we owned a company, I don't think we're having that conversation as easily as we did 15 years ago. Now, what does that mean? I'm asking you, what does that mean? Does it mean we just moved to Vietnam or Thailand or something where it is wide open or what? I don't know.
I think, yeah, that's part of it. I think we go to other countries, or I think that's what is also sustained inflation, because we can't find the cheap labor here in the States. That sort of moved back towards make it in America, or, you know, try to give more create more opportunities here. And you know what's really ironic, Chief, is that if you listen to the prior administrations talk about making America great again and trying to bring more jobs here, in reality, the current administration has actually done more of that. And and the same holds true with our exports of energy and oil in particular. So it's really, it has been sold as a political situation, but it isn't necessarily. What we're doing is we're just sort of, is a reaction to what has gone on in recent years that has now made us more energy dependent, I mean, less energy dependent in terms of foreign countries, and also more jobs coming here. And that's part of what has continued to spark our, or continue to lead our strong job market. We continue to have a very solid job market, which translates into a very strong economy, which translates into higher inflation. So that, I think, is going to continue here. And this is a different trend than what we were seeing in 2019 or pre-pandemic.
Well, I think that a lot of the, you and I have talked about this. I've talked about a couple other guests, is the oil thing. I mean, and we have, you know, people on the show, I'm not going to say unfortunately, because it's fortunately they're here for sure. It'll say, you know, this administration has been horrible towards oil. And yet, guess what? We're kicking ass on oil. I mean,
we are.
And so now, in words, shall we say, in words, you know, cutting the pipeline back, which was Canada to the Gulf, it had really not much to do with anything other than that, and saying, okay, we've got 90 bazillion acres of federal lands, by the way, 80 bazillion of which don't have a well on them and maybe never will. We're going to cut back 20 bazillion just to pacify a certain group of people, saying we're doing all this stuff, and yet at the end of the day, we're drilling. We got more oil than we did last year. I mean, the industry, I think, is bigger than whoever it is in the office. The industry and the pricing. I mean, right now the price at $80 were sort of been right for a while. The pricing there, and the fact that in these, what's the place in Texas? The name of that field down there. The fact that the fracking, I think when the price went down to $28-$30, I think it cost you, I'm just lobbing this one out there, Dan, it probably cost $45 to get a fracked oil. A fracked oil, how's that for a term? And now I'm going to say those guys have gotten their price of oil down to where they can probably make money at $35. So all of a sudden now they're not as worried about oil going from 80 to 55 as they were, or 45 as they were a couple years ago. Why would they be? I mean, their cost is less. So the efficiency, those kind of things, that's why oil prices, oil production is going up here, not because Biden says yes or no. I mean, unless he's going to cut the whole thing off, which nobody would. I mean, the industry is, and yet everybody continues to have this massive political, you know, so what? I'm not defending the man. I don't want to do that. But so what if he throws a few bucks at electric industry or something other, or does this kind of thing? Fact is, we're producing more than we ever did. And the right. Saudis pulled some crap this week. What it bounced oil for a dollar for what, an hour? That was about it.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, they're nowhere near the force they were in 1973, are they?
Absolutely not. No, and they're nowhere near the force that where they were 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It's definitely changing, and it is, I think, for us, changing for the better. And I do think energy independence is really important. The shift towards alternative energy, renewable energy, and all that is alive and well. And it is, I think, people have finally sort of calmed down about this and realized that the people who are pro alternative energy have realized that this is a work in progress, and it is happening, and it is absolutely happening. It doesn't need to be rushed. It just needs to be happening in a very controlled growth manner. And so I think we're in good shape there when it comes to the energy side. There's, you know, this, you know, one concern that has kind of come out this week in particular, the last few days, is just the concern about the fiscal deficit. That's nothing new, but it's something that's still there. You know, obviously there's some concerns about real estate markets in certain parts of the country. That's still there. However, it's not across the board yet. It's not like what we saw in 08. We don't see the same triggers that we did in 08. That could lead to a, you know, a really soft real estate market. It's really more regional at this point. There are the geopolitical risks, and there are the, you know, the concerns about what's happening. But just have an interview about 10 people in different fields over the past year, the past week, most people do not see a huge difference, or are not, people aren't too concerned about what's going to, the outcome of the November election in terms of how it's going to impact our U.S. economy. Because the way we are, the way things are going right now, they're actually going pretty good relative to where they had been and where they could be. So this is not a bad environment. You know, the higher rates will stay around for longer. That's not a bad thing. There are a lot of retired investors or people approaching retirement that want to clip those high coupons and collect that, you know, for example, on the T-bill, collect that tax-free interest, state interest especially. So that there are good opportunities to make a decent, in, you know, amount of money. We did a quick and dirty back of the envelope. If you want to have a very conservative portfolio with our strategy, that would incorporate your strategy as well, you can easily get between 5.5% and 8%.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's and that's not bad, and this is an environment where you can get that without a lot of risk. So this is not a bad time to have a large portion of your portfolio in bonds, in protected strategy. Chasing AI is, you can do a little bit of that with your personal money in your personal account, and hopefully you'll make some money on that. But again, the bigger picture here is that you don't need to take all the high beta risk in this environment to earn a decent return.
Actually, Dan, I'm going to push back on one hairy piece there, hairy piece. I agree with you 99%, except if we had a client that really wanted to push the AI and gave us five stocks, let us do it. We'll do it in a way less risky manner than you will. And we'll get you,
yes,
70%, 70 delta long with finite risk, and let us do that. Instead of it collapses, instead of losing 100, you're going to lose 30. We're actually as important there as we are on the other stuff, I think.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really being able to risk manage, you know, to manage risk, and that's the most important thing. I have one other thing I want to mention, and it's something I've mentioned in the past, but having been a bond manager my entire career, I think it's really important because the listeners, I know, have had questions about whether it makes more sense to buy individual bonds versus buying a bond mutual fund, the mutual fund that has bonds in it. I managed bond mutual funds for many years, and I can tell the listeners with a lot of confidence that they are not the best investment. You have capital gains distributions that you have to pay on each year, whether or not that fund is up. You have high fees, high embedded fees in these funds, which you don't have if you buy individual bonds. You also have a very difficult time as a portfolio manager trying to get a target duration. In other words, if you want to set your duration at, on the short end, at say 2 or 3, very difficult when you have a portfolio of bonds to do that, because it's going to be constantly changing. Actively managed bond funds, what we do with individual bonds, have historically paid more, have given you better returns, have given you lower risk, and is you can do more customization in a bond fund if you buy individual bonds.
Well, that's because you take
always the case with equities. However,
Dan, you take
with
the
equities,
you take
same
the
story applies.
You take you the know, time to go see the place. That's why the place,
yes,
the places. Out of 100 places, you're going to rarely have somebody that goes belly up. If you just buy 100 at random, you're liable to get a few. And you're going to go see the guy, and nobody else will.
Yeah, and doing the homework on the names makes a huge difference. But also being able to manage duration, being able to manage the yield curve, that it's much easier to do when you buy the individual bonds. And we do have a huge advantage there, trading on an international institutional platform where we have much higher inventory and a much larger selection of bonds that are going to give us better yields. We're able to buy them at better prices.
Yeah, just to reiterate here how right you were earlier about the oil. I mean, I know you know you're right, but I don't even know if you know how right you are. I'm just going to go back to 2008, and I'm going to say that somewhere today, if you and I went in five libraries and five bars, there's going to be somebody who's railing on, and you know, I've stopped being a Democrat, I'm in the middle, but somewhere along the line here, the facts got to get in the story. And oil, everybody rails on how we're burying the oil industry. And there's people on the show that have said that. We're burying the refinery. It's total BS. When Obama took office, he took office in what, 2008?
Right.
Now, this is not him. This is not... The oil industry was mired. In 2003, there were 5.7 million barrels a day. 2008, now, when did what's his name? Bush Jr. get in, all right? Mr. Oil, oil company guy, right?
Right, absolutely.
He got in what, 2000? And then in February of that year, we were 5.8 million barrels per day. The dude leaves office in 2008. Mr. Republican in the oil industry, his old man was in it his whole life, big buddies of the Arabs. When he left office, we're down to 5.1 million. All right, so tell me how much he influenced the industry when he was here. Obama, did he even like oil? I have no idea. I've never talked to the man. I'm thinking he didn't like it as much as Bush. He wasn't in the industry, for God's sake. He comes in 2008, 5.1 million per day. He leaves in 2016, 9 million per day.
Right. All right.
A guy who hates the industry, right, according to everybody. All right, so he leaves in, 2016. Trump comes in, he comes in 2017. So 9 million a year. And when he leaves, there's 9 million a year. No, actually, he's up from... he's 9 million to 9 million. So it grew during his administration. Now he had the COVID and the other stuff that worked against him. He had that horrible, horrible time when the prices went way down. So I'm sure as hell not blaming it on him at all. Now he leaves, and this guy comes in, hates oil. February 2021, 9.9 million barrels a day. Today, 13.1. So
exactly.
Define hate to me. It's all BS.
I absolutely agree 100% with what you're saying.
You guys are not considering the supply side.
What do you mean the supply? That's what I'm saying. The industry is driven more on price and all the other stuff. It's a massive industry. It's way bigger than whoever in the Oval Office chooses to do it, unless he's going to shut it down or something.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
The contention would be that the price could probably be around $50 if they let him go.
They let who go?
If they let the
those are people that don't know anything. If you start talking about the U.S. lands that aren't drilled, nobody wants to drill there. There's no roads. There's no. I'm not saying that some of the stuff hasn't had some effect, Greg. I am, but this idea that we're not going to go from the fact that if it's up 4 million barrels since the guy got in office, and again, he's no favor to the. But now we're going to drop back to the secondary argument. If it wasn't him, and it had been, if Trump was still in there, it'd be 16. That's a zero argument. How do you know that?
Well, the supply has increased a lot.
Yeah. So how does the supply increase? Because we're drilling more.
No, not necessarily. The fracking.
Okay. Well,
takes old mine or old wells.
Whatever it is, we're producing almost 40% more than the man took office.
Right, and the contention would be that the supply has gone up way more than 40%.
Okay. The contention would, you know, whatever. I don't know. But where do you go with that argument, Dan?
I liken it to what's happened with the financial markets too. So they kind of parallel, right? So
sure
as oil supply has increased here, oil exports have increased here in the States, our financial markets have actually improved. I mean, we continue to break new records, and this has been during the time of an administration that we didn't necessarily think was going to be giving us these results. what I will say that I like about the current administration in that regard, and the same with oil, is that there hasn't been any type of forced regulation, if you will. There's just been an encouragement to produce more at home. There's been an encouragement to bring it back to America. And I you know, there, with the equity market and the bond market, again, the good thing about, say, Obama's second term, and about, you know, the more in more recent times, is there hasn't been attention focused on trying to drive the market up. It's doing it on its own. It's doing it on its own because we're at that point in the cycle, and we're at that point in the cycle because there's no external forces that are like corporate tax cuts that are going to continue to drive it. And I think that organic growth that we're getting in this period is much more so sustainable than some kind of supply, you know, some kind of supply side or trigger growth that is coming from a source like corporate tax cuts or some other type of regulation that's going to improve the market.
Well, if you pour money into the system, the market's going up.
Absolutely. That's
and these guys have done a lot of that. I don't know how
they on both sides, right?
I have two very serious questions for you. Now, let's go back to the bond discussion and how people should be revaluing their portfolio, because I think a lot of people want to hear that, Dan, out of you and me. But where the how is the government going to close the published deficit? I mean, I don't see how they can continue to do the trillion something a year in the whole deal on the published number. I mean, how is that someplace somewhere? Whoever the next president is, one of these two guys, I guess we're going to be stuck with. Somewhere next year, somebody's going to have to do something. I mean, it's going to be a tax cut nobody wants, or a tax raise nobody wants. It's going to be some cuts someplace nobody wants. But I don't see how you even these guys can't. Even the group of people that says as long as your growth is more than your growth in debt has to realize those are not matching up now. I mean, it's getting too big to ignore. I mean,
it is.
What do you think happens? I mean, you can't. I don't think. I mean, I don't see Trump coming flying in with a tax increase or something. But I don't know how the hell you. I think a lot of people that are being stuck with inflation, the last thing they need is a tax increase. I don't know where you're going to get that out of them. Can't get blood out of a turnip, the Irish say.
There's no question it's a problem, and I think it's one of the biggest concerns right now. Not only the fiscal deficit, but just sort of the increase in debt, both at the household level, at the government level. You know, we learned in basic economics, it's coming across. You know, it's coming in all of the major areas of our economy. So that is a given. Higher rates are going to exacerbate that because we're expected to see higher rates going forward. The only thing that could be done would be a shift in terms of where money is going and how money is being spent. So the government spending, for example, would have to shift. There would have to be some sort of shift on the focus of, you know, or having a goal or a target, because right now it doesn't seem like we have a specific target. We have a target on inflation, but we don't have a target in terms of getting the deficit down. So there'd have to be a shift, and maybe once we start approaching the target on inflation, then there'll be more focus on approaching the fiscal deficit and taking a look at how ways to kind of bring that back in line, or at least back in moderation. It's going to be a challenge because we have higher rates. It's going to be a challenge because at some point people aren't going to have the amount of money they've had. That money is being spent right now. It's been spent over the last few years, and this is definitely probably one of the biggest challenges that our economy faces.
What age group is? I think I was reading last night or maybe this morning. Greg, what's 22 to like 28? Is that Gen Z or Gen X, or who are those guys? That's not you. Who's behind you?
I think that's Z.
They're saying,
and then Alpha's after that.
Right, because they're saying that group has so much debt it's scary. Credit card debt and everything.
Yeah.
Most of them don't even have families yet. They said the debt in that age group is off the chart.
And the unfortunate part, Chief, is that what's missing is the education for students going through even grade school, high school, and into college in what I call personal finance. It's just really amazing to me how little people know. And when these students or 20-somethings are trying to get information, they do not rely on the senior people who've been in the industry forever. They're relying on their what they can find on the internet. And oftentimes, as we know, there are many different articles that stress, that have different opinions on how to get there. And I think that often confuses them in terms of what needs to be done. There are, fortunately, I have some clients in that age group who are generally the children of clients, and part of what I do is try to help them out. I do find that I get a lot of resistance from people, and it's not just the younger people you get the resistance from. It's older people who are not in our industry, but really seem to know a lot more about it than we do at times.
Oh yeah, well, everybody's an expert. I mean, that's
in everyone's an expert. Yeah. But the problem with everyone being an expert is that people aren't focused on what needs to be done to improve their personal balance sheet. And that is, anytime we've gone through a crisis in the late 80s and early 90s, what came out of that were companies improving their balance sheets. That's why they were able to sustain a good financial position throughout the 90s. Likewise, the same thing will have to happen with individuals, because this is the first time in 15 years that we're faced with higher rates, that we're faced with a higher level of debt on the personal side. And for a lot of people, it's just put it on the credit card. Well, this is going to become an issue, and is already becoming an issue, but the issue is only going to exacerbate if there isn't a focus on educating people to understand the ramifications of what's happening here. We haven't seen much in the way of bankruptcy, whether personal or corporate. So corporate bonds, this is what I've done my whole career, still have a very low default rate. I think the higher default rates are in front of us. It's part of the cycle we go through. And the higher default rates are going to put not necessarily an end to this economic growth, but they're going to continue to slow down growth. Additional spending is going to be probably cut back at some point. Right now, there's still a lot of money chasing AI, chasing those good companies that have upside potential. But
the wealth,
I think on the personal side, there needs to be some education.
Well, the income numbers, I tend to do that. We focus in on the income numbers, and we have guys like Carl talking about how, even though some of the hourly wages are up, the hourly paycheck is actually down the last few months, which he's never seen before. Yet, there's no question, even after the last week, the wealth has to be at all-time high. I mean, people own houses or own stocks. I mean, for God's sake, it's a whole different conversation when you have people that are spending their wealth versus, somebody gets, the old man croaks and they get, 2,000 shares of IBM, and by the way, they get a basis move up. They don't have to pay taxes on it. They sell it. That's like a lot of dough. Your wealth is pretty darn high. So we have sort of issues with that, and that's my concern, and I'm going to ask you, how do you even define some of these quote markets? I mean, when they used to give you a test in grad school, they'd say, assume a perfect competition, or assume a monopoly, assume a cartel, and the answers are all different, right? So when you look at like the housing market, and you're saying that the prices are going down in Florida because of the insurance stuff, and maybe they were just too high in the first place, but now Nancy was on Monday, and she and Audrey were telling me over the weekend that Nancy, there was a study that she just saw in her industry that out of 100 houses, 40 of them are owned free and clear. Now, I don't know what area this was, by older people and so forth. And that's 40% are owned free and clear. 38% are in people with mortgages that are less than 3.5 or 3.25 or something. So unless there's like a divorce or something, they're not going anywhere. So that leaves you with 22% of the homes in play. Now, if I was the professor or Greg was the professor, gives us that test, and they say, okay, define how the pricing is occurring in the housing market, given these constraints, it's not a monopoly, it's not an oligopoly, but it sure as hell isn't free either, Dan. I'm not so sure I don't get an F on that test. I'm not sure I've ever seen anything quite like that, have you?
I think we're definitely in a different environment here than we have been, and that's being driven by a number of different factors. You know, certainly the accumulation of wealth in recent years has been part of that reason, which is also what's driven up prices in certain parts of the country. I say the Northeast and Boston in particular, where I'm from originally. It's just amazing there's still bidding wars on homes there, and you know, just the cost of living just seems outrageous. But I think there's this trend is going to continue to change, and I think it's going to change as a lot of that money has worked, it continues to work its way through the system. And we said this a year ago, and we said this a year before that, that in time, once this money works its way through the system, even though a lot of that has been going on credit cards, people will continue to, for example, sell a house and then buy a new house with cash. But aside from those people, there's going to be a marked change in the housing market, and it's going to be I think there's going to be some other events that we aren't even discussing today that are going to exaggerate this new trend of probably more stabilization and lower prices.
Well, you mentioned earlier that the triggers for the housing crisis in 2007, 2008, the massive leverage, which mostly was what?
Yes.
Money coming from Japan, right? The leverage,
yes,
really kind of came from there. You know, you're right. There is no trigger that I can identify other than, but I also know by some of the work I've done, because I did it in 2007 and didn't get me anywhere because I didn't shorten anything. If you compare median incomes to median home prices, we're way worse now than we were then in terms of the average person affording the average house. So
absolutely.
The trigger is not there.
That has definitely changed.
Yeah, the trigger is not there, but the status of anything is worse. So
you go back to when my parents bought their house and my father had just finished law school his first year out, and they came from very poor families, and they bought the house that they still live in today in a nice suburb in Boston. So that would never happen with my generation,
no,
the baby boomer generation, it's not even a thought with the younger generations, the millennials and the Gen Zs. It just isn't even a thought because they're just so far removed from that. So that is a marked change in what's going on. And there have been some, you know, solutions to that, but it's also changed the traditional, you know, couple meets, couple decides that they want to marry, they want to have a family. First, they want to buy a home, and the sort of the process of being able to do that is quite different than it was when we were younger, and even more so when our parents were younger. There were many more opportunities. So that shift has taken place. Some of it has allowed people to move to different parts of the country that are more affordable. So we've seen some of that, but in the end, it is definitely a problem that's going to continue. Or if not a problem, it's definitely going to be a shift in the way people accumulate wealth and the way they look at buying real estate.
Well, you see it in the, you know, people are getting, I guess, generally, we're all pointing a finger at somebody, maybe are getting a little smarter. Dan, before 2007, you know, when a lot of young people came to work downtown here in Chicago, you had, you know, the daughter's coming down here, she's 23 years old, and she's going to go live in, you know, whatever, Wicker Park or somebody. And the old man goes, that ain't happening. You know, you're not parking in your car three blocks away there when you come home from a date at 2 a.m. and walking the two blocks. You know, I want you in a building with a doorman and in a garage. So all these condominiums down here, you know, Pops was buying for, you know, Judy and maybe Joe. And
right.
And then all of a sudden the 2007 to 2008 came, and they all got obliterated on those condos, right? Because they just were paying any price, thinking that they're just going to keep going up. Well, now, the prices are still strong, but, I mean, Audrey will tell you, especially in the city, and she doesn't like doing rentals, but she does some for people that have, like, bought the place from her or something. Put a rental property out there, any price, and you got 20 people. People are willing to pay anything to rent, but no, let's say nobody, a real lot of people are just not comfortable maybe with the city itself, with the job market, with the prices they want for actually to buy one. That, like Nancy would say, I've never seen rents so high compared to what even the mortgage would be if you bought the place.
Right. And, so, and I agree with that. And I think that's true in other cities as well. And one other point that we have discussed over time, and I brought it up because this was the part of the puzzle when we were looking at inflation over the years that hadn't quite happened. So, and that is wage inflation, that is jobs. So we had seen some inflation in the early years of the pandemic, but what we really needed to see is wage inflation. So that happened, wages went up. Now we're in an interesting period, and this has just been a very recent phenomenon, the last 6 months maybe, where these people who have been loyal to their companies, and I can name five people I know that are in this situation, who have been given these great work at home, work remote opportunities, are being either forced to come back into places that are on the other side of the country or take job cuts or terminate, you know, find other work. And I can name at least five people that I know in different industries. That is showing to me what that shows. That wasn't happening 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. To me, that shows that we are in this equilibrium, stabilization phase, and that we're weeding out the excess workers, and it was the excess workers or the lack of workers that we had before that was causing job wages to inflate. It's a different environment, and it's changing, and we're in the middle of that change. And although it's not good for these people and my friends who are in the situation, it is absolutely good for the economy.
Well, anybody, well, I'm just way too strong. Anybody who feels that you're going to get a job and never see anybody, never go there, unless it's a very specialized thing, I think you maybe should have thought twice.
Absolutely.
I mean, you've been in our area here. I'll tell you what, Dan, it bothers the bejesus out of me that the Federal Reserve has this massive building here with virtually not many people inside. I don't want my government salaries going to people that aren't here. And what is it doing to the restaurants and bars and people around here?
Totally agree.
But I mean, for instance, if you, I think you'll agree with this, but you could say, I don't want to see, I don't know. I mean, I would say that if, say you and I, you know, got so many clients together, we actually wanted to have one office or something, and for whatever reason we decided it was here, well, hell, I want your judgment all day long. Every time we do a trade or something for somebody or you for something, well, hey, Dan, what do you think? Do you like this Walmart? You like the Disney? What do you like here? Disney got its ass kicked? I want to be able to. That's why we have an investment group. I don't want to have to go track you down in Hawaii and hopefully you're not walking the dog somewhere. I mean, who's kidding who? I mean, if we're going to work together, I'm not saying that on a Friday you can't say, hey, I'm golfing in the afternoon. How about if I just call in from Friday morning? I'm not saying, oh, no, you got to be here or you're fired. You know that. But I'm saying along the line, I mean, how can the people at Google and those kinds of places who spent years talking about everybody being together, not even have cubicles where you're blocked off from somebody, and how the intermixing of ideas was the reason why that place got as well? How can you go from that a year later saying everybody works at home and never see each other? One of them can't be, they both can't be right.
I think the first one that you mentioned where they all work together in this camaraderie, the most important part is a free flow of ideas that way. And it could be what they used to call what the water bubble conversations where, you know, it just gets people talking. And I think that to me, in my career, that has been one of the healthiest ways of learning, being able to, when I started out at Luma Sales in Boston as a portfolio manager, and just going into the offices of the analysts and picking their brains and having conversations. And, you know, you can't face to face, you can't beat that knowledge, that camaraderie, that interplay, that getting those different perspectives, getting the detailed information. And I think it does support a more collaborative work environment, which, you know, and if you have a work environment, a team that is working well together, your outcome is going to be much better.
Well, I agree totally. I mean, I remember Matty Weber when he went to work like the first day for a while, and he goes, Chief, I can't believe how, like, how much time I wasted. Instead of talking to these guys, I could have been, like, vacuuming. And I go, Matt, vacuuming is not exactly... If you're on the clock, vacuuming your house isn't exactly what I'm paying you for. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
But, I mean, your mentality can change. All right, Dan, let's talk portfolios. I was talking yesterday. I was kind of wished you were on it because we got 5 minutes. How many people right now, if you look at where the interest rates have been over the last 5-6 years, and I'm not going to say we're back to traditional stuff now, although we're a lot closer than we were, and a person comes in, either somebody special needs, work, when I say special needs, concentration issue, working for doing an estate, retired. If you and I were to with their help, because obviously you do it for individual people and everybody's different, with their help, put together what a portfolio today maybe should look like, at least, you know, going in, not that you don't adjust stuff as you go. How many people's current portfolio matches that? I'm going to say less than 10%.
I would agree. Yeah, I would agree. I've been quite surprised at a few of the prospects that we've had, and even just talking to a few friends that have asked for help and how their money is currently situated. And one guy in particular I'm thinking of, you know, did quite well in his career and is retired now, and is trying to convince me, or maybe he was trying to convince himself by talking to me about how his, you know, a fair amount of his money is in tech stocks and AI and all that. And I was saying, you know, that's great, but, you know, we're at a point in the market right now where it's good to take some of that off the top. Chief, I can't tell you how many times I've had that conversation with people, and even just the past few weeks, listening to people who had, you know, single stock exposure, you know, stock specific exposure, you know, that company stock or something, saying that stock has run and run and run. This is time to take a piece of that off, to trim some of that, and to diversify and to protect. We're in a perfect environment to capture some of those returns that we've earned, take out some of the risk of the portfolio with both your strategy, the protective strategy, and our strategy, the fixed income strategy. That's going to really give your portfolio strong diversification, a strong foundation, some good income, and you can still have some of those names or maybe a smaller position of some of those concentrated stocks. But this is the time, and there's going to be a window when this can be done, especially if you're in the process of retiring. So absolutely, this is one of the best times that I could see. We're making that shift, makes a lot of sense.
Well, it also, as you know, because everybody's a person. This is the part that ruffles me about the firms that just jam the square peg in the round hole.
I mean, yes.
If you and I are having a lunch and somebody sat down and said, I want you guys to look at my portfolio, I got $100,000. I love this AI. I'm balls out $100,000 in AI. You and I are going to raise our eyebrow. But then he might say, you know, I make $1 million a year. I own this company. It's worth like $2 billion. First time I've ever invested. And by the way, I got, you know, how many bazillion dollars in the credit union. We might say, leave your $100 in there, knock yourself out. Right, you know, I mean, it depends on the person. Now, if the guy's 85, yeah, and he's never going to work a day in his life, and he's 100% in AI, you and I might say, yeah, if I gave you that money today, would you put it all in there? Well, no, but it's a big winner. I can't get rid of it. Well, that's when you have the conversation about, would you buy it today here? I mean, some of the answers, Dan, you and I don't even have to do it. I remember the best one was, this is years ago, a guy comes in and he says, well, I've got whatever it was, you know, 3,000, 4,000 shares of Exxon. I said, wow, that's cool. Where'd you get that? You know, my dad had it and he died. Now it's mine. And so it was like 90% of his portfolio. And I said, well, do you want to lighten up at all? Oh, no. You know, we've had the Exxon forever and so forth. I said, okay, forget that question. Another question. If I gave you $2 million cash, and you know I'm a broker's firm, before you even leave here, give me an order to buy $1.8 million in Exxon. Well, hell no. Okay, well, but that's what you got. And he said, right. He goes, well, yeah, but my dad had. I said, is your dad still alive? No, I'm sorry to hear that. By the way, if your dad was here, what would he say? He'd say it was too much. I didn't even have to have the conversation.
Right, you're right. He answered it himself. Yeah.
Because most people, I mean, hell, people think, you know, that I'm lying or I'm nuts. I might be nuts, but I'm not lying. Every morning, Dan, when I was on the trading floor, we searched for positions. I was in the OEX. We probably had positions in 45, 50 stocks around the floor. Something volatile is you got a line, we do this, we'd be short premium this one, long premium that one, that type of thing. And I had two guys working for me, maybe even three when my brother came in, that all they did was manage those other stocks. And every morning we'd get the big list of the big sheet of graphs, so we'd have to look at the TV. And I go, well, this in a stock, say you made money in one, you were long and it went up $3 the day before. The first thing I'd say was, well, all right, we got to fix this one. We're too long, you know, type of thing. We got to adjust it a little bit. But every single one of those on a daily basis didn't match, not every single one, but say half of them needed adjustment every day or two.
Right.
So it's not like you owe the position anything or anything. You're just,
right.
You know, you're looking at it and you're saying, here's what my goals are. Here's what fits. And by the way, this probably doesn't match. It doesn't mean you're an idiot. It doesn't match. It may mean that you bought a stock that tripled. that doesn't make you an idiot. It just means it doesn't match anymore, right?
Right. You got to manage it. It's not just put it in there and sock it away, because you know that we're not in that environment anymore where you can do that, because too many other influences are changing that, and you got to have somebody keeping on top of it every day. So,
Dan, are there any bigger companies now? I know the rates are still going out a ways, and not gonna. Just last question, but are there any bigger? I mean, is it time to buy a 5-year bond in Boeing or Caterpillar? I'm not talking about individual company. Are we even close to that?
It's a good question, but the thing that is keeping us from doing too much of that, and we have been doing some of that, the thing that's keeping us from doing too much of that is the shape of the yield curve.
Okay.
So, for example, if you're getting 5.44, which you are today on your 3-month, but in your 5-year you're only getting 4.60, then just that difference in yield, if you're looking for the income, is going to be significant. So you can buy a single B-rated bond that has a short-term maturity and get close to 7%. That's a good buy. That same bond that's 5 years out is not going to be the same credit quality. You're going to get the same yield, but you have a wider spread, and you're probably going to have to pay up for it or take more risk. So this isn't the ideal time to be doing that. Once the yield curve flattens, it will be.
So we're
for several reasons, but that's in the future. Right now, stick with the shorter term high yielding. Pemex is a company, for example, the Mexican cement company that has a bond that matures next year, 7.1%, 6 7/8 coupon. Money good, definitely has a little bit of geopolitical risk, but they have traditionally done well and paid off. And, you know, so I think that type of bond, if you can find that amount of yield in the short end, is going to pay and it's going to give you like some sense of comfort that you're going to collect this interest and principal when it matures.
They used to be a pretty decent trader. What was the oil company? They were a huge trader, the Mexican oil company. Are they still around?
Yeah, I mean there were several. I mean there's
well, the one the actual government one. It was a big trader for a while. What was those guys' name?
I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, man. It was Pemex was the concrete company, and the other guys were the oil company. I forget what the hell it was.
Yeah, there's Cemex and Pemex and Petroleum. It's on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah, me too. Well,
Xerox is another one too. They have a 5% coupon due in August 25th. You get in 6.30. You know, that's a pretty decent decent rate. But again, if you compare the 6.30 to what you can get in a 3-month T-bill at like almost 5.5, that's only 80 basis points more, and you are taking on credit risk. So the timing based on the yield curve is not ideal. However, with some homework, which is what we do, we're finding some good opportunities.
Well, you'll tell us the timing. Right now, it's just so easy for me to say a customer calls, and I'll just say, hey, add Joe $300,000 to next Monday's auction. You know, I mean, It's easy to do that. I mean,
and it's not going to be anytime soon that we see rate cuts. So I would still say ride this wave with higher rates.
All right, bud. Thank you. Have a nice weekend. Talk to you next week.
You too.
S&P futures down 2. NASDAQ futures are up 6. So we've come back a little bit. We're back to like being flat. I hope it's not as boring as yesterday, but it might be. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.